Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 295. We're going to talk about 10 stupid emergency hacks. Folks, these are really, really dumb things. But they can get you out of trouble. We're also going to talk about, tire screws, the good ones and the bad ones. We'll have a tale from the road about avoiding imminent death and a resource recommendation that might help you save gas. Maybe, kinda, sorta. We shall see. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Sorry I am a day late, but once again, I've got myself overcommitted, but yet still committed. And that's why we have a podcast this week. So I had one of these shower thoughts of kind of many of the stupid things I have done over the years. And some of them were kind of stupid smart. You know, it's the kind of stuff that would make a good TikTok video these days, although back then those things didn't exist. But I thought maybe I would share them with you, but I have to give you a warning. These 10 things I'm about to share are really not smart. None of them are the best way to do something, and many of them could be described as the worst way to do something. I mean, seriously, these are things that could actually be dangerous. So treat this as an entertaining story of a list rather than stuff you actually might want to do. But, you know, when you're in an emergency, sometimes you got to do what you got to do to get out of that emergency. And, well, there's an element of that in each of these things. So number one, I was stuck with my wife at the time, on the New York State Thruway west of New York City, and we were just in a ton of traffic heading west. We're actually moving to Utah from Massachusetts, so there were three of us in a caravan. I was in a little tiny motorhome, a Toyota Mini Cruiser. My wife at the time was in a 1984 Toyota Tercel. And this other person with us was in a Tempo, and they are not part of the story. The Tercel started acting up. It was hot, and we were in bumper-to-bumper traffic, and the car just kept stalling. In fact, anytime she would apply the gas, it would just stall, and we were stuck. We were in bumper-to-bumper traffic, and this state trooper turned on his lights and pushed his way through traffic and came up to us and yelled at us, telling us that we need to move that car right away. But we were in a situation, and this is before cell phones, where, we were stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic. We couldn't, just call a tow truck or anything. And, I thought, we'll tow it. Problem is, in order to tow a car, you need, hopefully, a tow strap. But I didn't have anything like that. I didn't even have paracord, because it wasn't really a thing back then. I didn't have rope. I didn't have clothesline. I had nothing to tow this car with. But I did have jumper cables. And yeah, I hooked up the jumper cables to the back of the camper and to the front of the Tercel through the hooks. Now, the Tercel had a nice hook right under the engine that you could hook up to. And of course, the camper had big, huge things in the back. So that part was easy. And I towed her to the next exit that way. But it wasn't as simple as that. I had to instruct her very carefully that anytime she saw the brake lights of the camper come on, she had to apply the brakes of the car immediately. And the car wasn't running, so she had to press the brakes much, much harder than she normally would. And inevitably, what would happen is I would step on the brakes to slow down a little bit, and she would slam on her brakes, jumper cables to get tight, and then brake. So I had to use a sheet bend, which is a type of Boy Scout knot that you would use to attach two pieces of rope together, to attach the broken cable. And as we proceeded, the cable got shorter and shorter because it broke like five times. But you know what? As stupid as that is, and yes, it did ruin jumper cables, it worked. We got her to a mechanic at the next exit, and they said it was some sort of vapor lock, and basically it was a carburetor problem. The carburetor wasn't dealing with the heat well, and some really high-test gasoline fixed it. But, don't do that, but, you know, it worked. Number two, this is not mine. I didn't do this, but I've seen it done many times. This is a tractor hack that I have seen applied to cars and vans stuck in the sand. And that is you take a 2x4 or a section of 2x4, say a 1 foot section of 2x4, and you tie it to the tire. You place it on the tire, and then you wrap ropes around it through the wheel. And, you know, obviously you're not doing this around the axle. You're lashing it to the tire. And the reason you do this is that if you're stuck in the mud or in the sand, the 2x4 will spin around and catch the sand or mud and throw the car forward. You can see why this is dangerous. You could imagine this 2x4 coming loose and being shot into the air or into your car or wherever. And you could easily damage your vehicle with this, especially modern vehicles with all their sensors and electronics under there. Again, this was a tractor hack from, you know, probably the 40s or 30s, where tractors were really just an engine hooked up to a wheel and not much more. It wasn't safe then. It's certainly not safe with modern cars. But you can find videos of people doing this, and it works. Number three, this actually happened to me. I was in Death Valley in a rental SUV, a little Dodge Raider, not the kind of vehicle that's, you know, super heavy duty, but, you know, it'll kind of get you out there. It did have four-wheel drive. And we had a lovely time out there exploring the geologist's cabin and striped Butte Valley and all that. We were trying to get to Barker Ranch, but the wash was out. We couldn't do it in that car and gave up, turned around. Anyway, starting to get dark. Person with me was asleep, and the tire light comes on the dashboard. Low pressure. I'm like, rental car, I don't know, whatever. I keep driving, and then I start to notice the car is handling a little differently, and I get out and look, and I got a flat tire. Well, that sucks. So I go and try to get the spare. I found the jack, and I found the lug wrench, but the spare was missing. I don't know if somebody had stolen the spare from this rental car or if somebody had used it. I don't know, but there was no spare. So I basically had three good tires and one bad tire, and I'm in Death Valley, maybe an hour and a half or so from anywhere where I could get any kind of help, and probably that an hour from pavement where I was. And it was getting dark. The person I was with was not the type of person who could, deal with a night in the desert in a rental car. And what would the night have done? Like, and what would spending the night have gotten us? We still need to get out there. So I made the decision that I was just going to drive, and it would probably ruin the tire and maybe the rim. And, oh well, I mean, there was nothing else I could do. But then I remembered that I had this little emergency kit that I had brought with me that had a lot of water and some stuff to start a fire. And at the last second, I threw a can of Fix-A-Flat in there. And when I looked at the flat, I was able to see the cause of the flat right away. It was a cactus spine that had gone through the sidewall. Now, everyone will tell you that Fix-A-Flat cannot fix that. Fix-A-Flat isn't going to help you with a sidewall puncture. Sidewall punctures are pretty much the death of a tire. That's the end of it. You're done. But this was an emergency situation. And so I started thinking about it and was like, well, if I pump it up with the Fix-A-Flat, I can at least maybe get a few more miles before all the gas leaks out. But then I thought, well, how does Fix-A-Flat work? It's a sticky liquid, and you pump it into the tire, and then it pools with gravity. And as you drive, basically that gooey stuff goes around the inside of where the tread is and fills any holes, and then hopefully hardens and stops the leak. That's what it's supposed to do. On the sidewall, it never gets there because the sidewall's on the side. So gravity will never get the liquid onto the side. And then I thought, that's because the tire is on the vehicle. If I take the tire off the vehicle and then put the Fix-A-Flat in such a way that it pools on the side of the tire, maybe that will work. And so that's what I did. I jacked up the Dodge Raider, got the tools, took off the wheel, and it was a little awkward because I had to hold the tire up as I filled the Fix-A-Flat because the filling tube was on the same side as the puncture. And then I filled it up, I rolled it around a little bit, and then I just let it sit there, puncture side down, meaning that all this fluid that I had just put in the tire would hopefully fill in the sidewall. I had very little hope that this would work. But I thought, what the heck? It's worth an effort. I'll give it 20 minutes. After 20 minutes, I was surprised to see that the tire still held air. It was not leaking in any way that I could see. So I put it back on the vehicle. Tire light was still on because the pressure wasn't right. I didn't care. But I was able to drive all the way to a gas station with no problem. And when I got to the gas station, I still didn't have a spare tire, but I filled that tire up to the recommended pressure, and it held. In fact, overnight, it held. It was fine. And in fact, I'm not terribly proud of this, but I just turned it into the rental car place without telling them about it, because screw them for not giving me a spare tire with my car. Stupid. Sidewall repairs are not ever wise. They're not. That's the end of the tire. Sidewall damage is the end of the tire. But it got me out of the desert. Number four. Old-time mechanics know a trick, and it's incredibly dangerous these days, and I don't recommend it, but it does work. And that is, if you're trying to get a belt on, and this is more for old-style fan belts than the new serpentine belts. This would not work with a serpentine belt. But if you have an old-style fan belt, which used to be there would be a pulley coming off the engine, and then there would be the starter and the generator or alternator and the fan belt. That would be it. And they would each have separate belts. So the pulley would have separate grooves. Well, they were super tight, and the belts were made out of this material that didn't stretch very much. Serpentine belts stretch a lot more than this stuff. And it was very difficult to replace belts, and only really good mechanics would know how to do it well. But, you know, mechanics are in a rush like most people, and so they learned this trick where you had somebody get under the car or in the hood, hold the belt up against where you wanted it to go, and then turn the key to start it just a little bit. You'd normally undo the spark plugs or the distributor or whatever it was to make it so that there was no chance the car could start. But the idea was you would kind of jerk it so that the starter would grab the belt and put it on properly. Crazy dangerous. Very, very common. And in fact, with my Winnebago, 73 Winnebago that broke down on me about 10 minutes after I bought it, that's how they got the belt on. These two guys, young guys, spent like 2 hours trying to get the belt on. They went and got different size belts. They couldn't figure it out. And then the old grizzled mechanic came out and said, "What are you guys doing? Get out of the way." And, you know, "All right, turn the key, not too much." And yeah, it was on in 5 minutes. And he didn't lose any fingers, at least not that time. So, stupid. And it worked. This one isn't so stupid. And it does work, but it's, I don't know. Let me tell you the story. This was my idea, but it wasn't my car. I was in high school, and I used to get a ride to school from one of the teachers. Now, I went to a private school that was in a different town, so this teacher had to drive to school every day, and teachers don't make a lot of money, so he created his own little carpool service where he would take all the kids in the neighborhood that went to this private school and take them over to school with him. I mean, it just kind of made sense, but he bought this old beater of a car. I mean, this ancient car, and that's what we drove in, and this thing was in terrible shape, and it had this problem where there was carbon buildup in the cylinders. And what happens with that is that as you drive it, the carbon gets super hot. It gets glowing red hot, and when you turn the engine off, it doesn't turn off because the glowing carbon is acting like glow plugs, which doesn't make sense in a gasoline engine, but it's enough to keep the engine sort of running. And so you turn the thing off, and it'll just keep going. Bang! It would always end with this huge bang. And it was kind of embarrassing. I mean, the poor guy, you know, he'd roll into school with this thing, turn it off, it would go through all these gymnastics, and then go bang. And everybody would be like, "Oh, Mr. Hoffmaster's here." Anyway, I'm watching this and just learning how cars worked. I had just gotten my driver's license, but had no car, hence I was in the carpool. And I was like, you know, when we stop this time, try this. And I told him to leave the car and drive, step on the brakes, and then turn the car off. And it just turned off. Now, he had to turn the car back on to shift it into park. Not start it, just turn the key to on. But doing that, it stopped the problem. Now, it didn't actually stop the problem. The problem was he needed a valve job or whatever he needed to do to clean out all the carbon out of there. But, stupid little trick that actually, so far as I know, he never fixed that. He just did that for as long as he had the car. Number six. This one is mine. This one is stupid. Stupid and embarrassing, and it worked. That same motorhome that I used to tow my ex-wife's car, I had a loose connection in the under the hood for one of the batteries, the starter battery. I mean, it was just the connection was loose. I don't know exactly what was going on, but the terminal post was too small terminal that led to the starter. Like, it was cranked all the way down, but it just didn't really make a good enough connection. And so maybe one time out of five, I go to start it and nothing happened. But I knew everything was fine. The starter was fine. The battery was fine. It was just the connection. Now, the way to fix this is to either replace the terminal or put in some kind of a shim or something like that. But no, I didn't bother with any of that. I would open the hood, grab the lug wrench, and whack it. I would whack the terminal. And these things are made out of lead at the time. I don't know what they're made out of now, maybe bismuth or something. But this thing was made out of lead. And whacking it would just make that connection good enough for one-time use to start the truck. And I did that probably for 2 months. It worked. It's really stupid, especially when you think about how simple of a problem that would have been to fix. But anyway, I'm just telling the stories here. I'm not trying to justify them. Number seven, this one is not dangerous or really stupid. It's just odd. When I bought that Winnebago, I knew I had to drive it across the country. I knew it was going to take a long time, and I knew I was going to be, like, driving for 2,000 miles. And it had the original radio, but the speakers were blown, so I had no entertainment at all. Now, the obvious thing would just be to wear headphones and use, you know, my phone or whatever, but I don't believe in using headphones while you're driving. I don't think it's a good idea. It was illegal when I was a kid, and I still think of it that way. This is not something you do in case you need to hear something. Plus, I'm driving this ancient vehicle. I want to be able to hear things like when, oh, say, the water pump freezes up. So I bought ATV speakers and brought them with me. I brought these Bluetooth speakers that are shaped like a tube. I actually linked them here at one point, but they're meant to be mounted onto the handlebars of an ATV. They're very loud, two speakers with a tube connecting them and a 12-volt power supply, and they don't have any controls. You just plug them in, and that's it. And then you hook them up to your phone via Bluetooth, and that worked. I had to carry them on the airplane out there to Grants Pass when I picked the thing up, but I sat it on the dashboard, bungeed it down, and that worked. I mean, it was funny because even cranked at full volume, I could barely hear these things. The Winnebago is so loud, but yeah, it worked. And I don't actually think that one was dangerous of all these things. Oh, number eight. Oh, all right. I told the story before, but it's still kind of embarrassing. When I was working on farms in Utah, one of the farms I had to work at was in Sandy, and I lived in Sugar House. So this is not a terribly far distance, but I only had a Vespa. That was my only transportation at the time, and it was a 125, which meant I couldn't take the highways. So I had to take all the back roads because my maximum speed in that thing was maybe 40 or 45. And this one night, it was getting late. I wanted to get home before dark, and I knew I was low on fuel, and there was no fuel gauge in this thing, I should remind you. There was a reserve tank and a main tank. That's how it worked. So when it started to sputter, you'd flip this knob, and you'd use the reserve tank. And in reality, there's only one tank. It was just two different pickups. That was how they dealt with low fuel. Instead of having a gauge, they would make you run out of fuel, so you knew you had to get fuel, and then you could turn the knob so you could use the last little bit of fuel. Anyway, I thought I was still on the main tank. So when I was driving and it started to sputter, I flipped it to reserve and it died completely because it was already on reserve. I had run this thing completely out of fuel. And that night, because it was late, I decided to take not the highway, but a higher speed road than I should have. Speed limit on this road was 50, no shoulders, two-lane road with a cliff on one side and like rock face on the other. And then I ran out of gas on my Vespa and it's getting dark and like, this is not a good situation. And yes, sure, I can push the Vespa. It's not like being stuck in a car, but I was miles from where I needed to go or anywhere I could even get to be safe. So, you know, I flipped up the seat and opened the tank, and I look in there, and, well, there's fuel in there, but, of course, the pickups can't get to it. And you know, I start thinking, well, there's fuel in there. The pickups can't get to it. It's the shape of the container that's the problem. So how do I fix that? I did a really, really stupid thing, and I definitely don't do this with a car. It's a different thing with a Vespa. I went and got the cleanest pebbles I could from the side of the road, and I started putting them in the tank, and then I basically filled the entire bottom of the gas tank with these pebbles. And what that did was it raised the level of the fuel just enough to get into those pickups, just to give me a couple more miles, which was all I needed. And it worked, and it was very, very stupid. And I got the couple miles, I was able to get fuel, and I just put 1 gallon in. And so I knew I had a big job ahead of me. Got home, and then fortunately this was a Friday, and then on the weekend, I burned off what little gas was there, and then I ended up, I had to flip it, and I literally, I couldn't even flip just the tank. I had to flip the entire Vespa upside down on its handlebars and get all those pebbles out. But, yeah, anyway, it worked. Number 9, this is not one I did. This is one my dad did in the 70s. He went to a big football game at, Schaefer Stadium, I think it was called then. It's where the Patriots plays, long before Gillette Stadium, or I don't even know what it's called now, but wherever the stadium is in Foxborough. And an old 1970 Pontiac Catalina that started to overheat. Back then, overheating was a little bit more common and a little bit different than it is now. And so it's overheating, and the thing everybody did back then is when the car's overheating, you want to release the pressure on the radiator, which is stupid. Never, never do that. Because when you do that, you get this geyser of boiling liquid that comes out, and all the only reason you do that is to help the engine cool down quicker because it gets all that hot fluid out. But don't do that. It's dumb. It was dumb then. It's dumb now. But of course, that's what they did. And then, of course, all that fluid's out. Well, what do? Well, they had a cooler, and the cooler had some water in it, but not very much, because they had left the drain open. As the ice melted, the water would drain out. But it had beer in it. So the beer was, colder than that hot fluid. And, yeah, they filled the radiator with beer and drove that way. And it worked. I mean, they got home, and I remember him pulling up to the house, turning off the car, and this just sea of foam comes out from under the hood and starts rolling down the street because we lived on a hill. And I was thinking of Willy Wonka, which was a movie I had seen not too long before this. And anyway, he explained, and he and my mother had some words, and we didn't have that car much longer. I don't know that it actually damaged the car, but that was the thing that happened. And finally, number 10, I have never done this, but I have heard of it being done. If you need to jumpstart a car and you don't have jumper cables, you can take the battery out of one of the cars, and as long as they're the same size battery, you can pick up that battery, flip it upside down, and put the posts together, positive to positive, negative to negative, and then you can start the other car that way. Absolutely should you never do this. This is really dumb, but it was apparently a common enough thing back in the day. And remember, these batteries are filled with liquid in most cases. So anyway, when you're stuck in an emergency, you might be willing to take more risks. But boy, I really hope you weigh them out properly, because some of the risks are just not worth the time you're going to save. And, sometimes they are. Thanks to everyone who has bought me a gallon of whatever at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Someone just became a member, and I appreciate it, and I don't know who you are, and that is okay. Thank you very much. Because of you and all the other folks like you, there are no ads on this podcast, and we're going to keep it that way. If you'd like to help out, go ahead and visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go, and you can buy me a gallon of whatever you would like, and I will appreciate it, and so will everyone else. Van life news. Let's see. Any good news this week? No, not really. But some of it's interesting, at least. First piece of news that Logan introduced to me. Thank you, Logan, in the Discord channel. He pointed out this Gear Junkie article that said that testing at 3 national park sites show more brain-eating amoeba activity, which is a concern. So brain-eating amoebas, as they're called, properly termed Naegleria fowleri, I mean, it's actually literal. It is an amoeba, and it gets into your brain, and it eats your brain. And there's more of these now than there have been. And this is a concern, because you can get this just by swimming in this water. You can also get it from putting pond water in your water tank and then taking a shower and somehow getting water up your nose. I mean that's the mechanism. It's getting water up your nose. So this is on the rise, and apparently it's on the rise because things are warmer now and this stuff likes warm water. So if you are the kind of person who's going to swim in ponds and rivers and streams and stuff, that's fine. Even if this amoeba's there, and you kind of should always assume it's there, just like you should always assume Giardia's there, just don't get water up your nose. Keep your head above water, and you should be fine. But you should know this stuff is on the rise, and the risk is greater than it has been. There's a link in the show notes to the Gear Junkie article, as there are with all of these. Winnebago has a very interesting new rig. I haven't seen one like this, since the 80s or 70s even, but it's a Ram 5500, a big Ram truck with a Class C style body on it. So the Ram 5500 is like the basic Ram pickup truck that you see, but the really, really super beefy version, four-wheel drive, four-door. And then they have a really nice build on the back. So it looks like a truck with a truck camper, except it doesn't come off. It's permanently attached. This is an adventure rig. If you've ever seen those Earth Roamers, this isn't quite as fancy as that, but it's trying to approach it. And I was very excited to see this. I was like, oh, good. Finally, people are starting to take risks and build some new rigs that are a little bit different that might meet lifestyles better. It's called the ARKA, A-R-K-A, completely meant for off-road. I mean, obviously you can drive it on the highway, but at only 26 feet, 7 inches long, it's not huge, and that's good because it'll fit in more places. It is designed to be off-grid for 14 days. Off-grid, that means it'll have enough water and power and everything for 14 days. And it's supposed to keep you comfortable from negative 10 Fahrenheit to 120 degrees. Fahrenheit. So that's like negative 20 Celsius to maybe 35 Celsius, somewhere around there. Sounds great. Sign me. Oh, you know, maybe don't sign me up for this. Even though that all sounds wonderful, the manufacturer's suggested retail price is $331,901. Yes. So to my thinking, you could buy a house and a boat and a nicely converted van for about the same money, and I think I would go that route. it weighs 20,000 pounds, so it's a big boy. But anyway, I'll have a link to that if you want to look at it, if you have an extra $340,000 laying around. But anyway, nice idea, guys. And John shared with us that there are some new campground rules coming, or at least being proposed, for America's national campground areas. And there are many. There's the forestry campgrounds, there's the national park campgrounds, there's a bunch of these. But these changes, well, at the very least, they make you raise an eyebrow. So this is from the Society of Environmental Journalists. It's an old-style blog, and the Interior Department has these new suggested changes that we don't know if they're actually going to happen or not, but they include things like allowing people to clean game in the restrooms. So if you've been to any of these restrooms on our public lands, they're not the nicest places usually. I mean, in the best circumstances, they're functional. Some of them are just vault toilets, you know, and they require constant maintenance because not everyone treats them properly, but they're going to allow people to, like, clean deer and other wildlife in there that folks have hunted. They're also going to loosen restrictions on how you can fire your weapons near trails. It's very, I don't know. I mean, I understand that there's a motivation to increase access to hunting for some folks, but this seems an odd way to go about it. I will link to this, and you can see it for yourself, but they're even doing things like removing tag requirements for hunting dogs, which, I don't know, I don't know what to make of this. This all seems kind of backwards and crazy to me. But hey, I'm just here to give you the news. And, well, there it is. Links in the show notes. Tech Talk. Okay, let's talk about Hantavirus. Okay, the Hantavirus has invaded my life because not only is it an issue in van life, it's also now suddenly an issue in the cruising world, and people are going crazy talking about it like being the next COVID. Oh, pump those brakes. Let's have a real talk about Hantavirus and what's real and what isn't. First off, the case of the cruise ship with Hantavirus. The story, the real story, is that an avid bird watcher, somebody who's actually fairly well known, caught the Andes strain of Hantavirus while touring South America. He caught it before he got on the ship. He brought it on the ship. Now, the Andes strain happens to be the only strain of Hantavirus that we know of that can be spread person to person. And that's what happened on this ship. This little tiny expedition ship. This is not any ship that ever comes to the U.S. You've probably never heard of it. It's a Dutch ship. Costs like $15,000 or so to go on the ship. I mean, this is not a normal mass market cruise. Anyway, he brings this well-known virus on this ship, and people start to get sick, and then they determine what it is, and now they're handling it. They went to the Canary Islands. The European Union is now going over things, and they're following protocol, and people are quarantined, and they are also looking for other people who came in contact with the ship before it was recognized. Because the problem with this thing is it's about a 6-week period of incubation. So this guy didn't have any symptoms or anything when he got on the ship. It started to develop on the ship. So that, you know, people came and went off this cruise. They had no idea that they might have this. So this all sounds very scary, and I understand this, but this is nothing like COVID. This isn't a novel coronavirus. This isn't a virus that we don't know that much about. It's brand new. We've never studied it. It's not a virus that is like a coronavirus, which is a well-known, very, very easily transmissible type of virus. It isn't that easy to catch Hantavirus. Consider this. These people are on a small ship. They're all eating in the same dining room. They're all gathering together in the evenings. And only a small, relatively small number of people caught the illness. There were hundreds of people on that ship. And last I saw, the total was 9 people who have contracted this. So it isn't that contagious. And people will be like, oh, well, you know, this is how COVID started. People just waved. This isn't COVID. This is something we know. It's not new. We've seen this before. There are dozens of cases every year in South America. We know how it happens, and we know what to do about it. So forget all that. None of that has any impact on van life at all. However, what does have an impact on van life is that Hantavirus is a dangerous disease. It exists in the southwest of the U.S. and basically in any place where there's a lot of rodent activity. Because of this, it is often recommended that if you go to the volunteer cabins in Death Valley, for example, if you see a lot of rodent activity in there, you don't stay in the cabin. You actually sleep in a tent outside the cabin. That's what a lot of people do, or some people even set up a tent inside the cabin. This is a virus that is spread in droppings and saliva and basically any rodent bodily fluid, and they leave that behind. And one of the things that's dangerous is that if you sweep up one of these cabins and create dust, you can inhale that dust and then get the virus. And that is a very, very bad thing. Remember, this is what killed Gene Hackman's wife not that long ago. They lived in New Mexico, and she got Hantavirus and did not get treatment. And the treatment may not have saved her, but it would have saved her husband, who Gene Hackman was suffering from severe Alzheimer's and not able to care for himself. So when she died, and nobody knew it, he just wasted away without anyone to care for him, which is very, very tragic. He did not have Hantavirus, to be clear. It was his wife that did. So, don't listen to me. I'm just a podcaster. Listen to somebody who knows what they're talking about medically and find that proper information and use it to inform how you camp. In short, avoid rodent activity. And this is also one of the reasons you can't allow rodents to hang out in your vehicles. You have to keep up on it. If you're in a situation like I am, where you have RVs that are idle and sitting and they do have rodents come in, you have to get rid of them. You have to get rid of them. Even in Illinois, there are cases of hantavirus. In fact, there's a suspected case that was reported a couple counties over from where my stuff is. And I am going to be following that because that has real impact, not this hantavirus cruise stuff. Was this tech talk? Kinda, sorta, but it was important talk. Product review. I am so surprised to be giving you this review right now. Maybe a year ago, actually probably longer than that, I talked about these new tire repair things. So for years and years and years, they've had these tire repair kits that were this kind of rubbery, leathery strip that you would stab into the hole in your tire with some kind of rubber cement, and then you'd yank out this T-handle thing and trim it off, and that would be that. It was a permanent repair, but it only worked in the tread of the tire. You weren't supposed to use it for sidewalls, although, of course, people did. And these things just tend to work. I mean, I've used them. They work pretty well. But I saw these things for cheap, which is not a good sign, that were basically screws that were coated in this, it looked like silicone, this kind of sticky substance. And the idea is that if you have a nail in your tire, you pull the nail out, and then you use a screwdriver, and you just screw this in the hole, and you're done. Fill the tire back up, and you're good to go. And that sounded way, way too good to be true, especially for like the $3 that the cheapest of these kits cost. But, all right, I figured I'm going to get one. I'm going to throw it in the car. I have the other kit in there too. And, you know, we'll see what happens. Well, as it happens, 2 weeks ago, I had three flats in one day. I had one in my truck and then two in my tractor, both front tires. And I had the kit and I was like, well, I guess this is the time to try it out. And so I predicted that I would use these things and they would just not work. They'd start leaking immediately, or it would work for an hour and then, you know, but whatever. I tried it and I repaired all three tires with these things. Now, they come with these little different size screws and you have to evaluate the situation. So, for example, in my truck, I had a screw in my tire, ironically. It took me a while to find it. It was a zip screw. The head had broken off and it was stabbed right through the thickest part of the tread, which is good. And, you know, I used some diagonal cutters and yanked those out of there. And then I had a hole and there was actively air coming out of it. And all right. So I took a minute to figure out what was the proper size to use. And it ended up being smaller than the one I initially wanted to use. And I put the screw at the hole. And this took a lot of effort. I hand screwed this tire repair thing into the hole. And I just kept screwing until the head of the screw, and it's a Phillips head screw. It's a little tiny half-inch Phillips head screw. I screwed it in until the head was below the level of the rubber, and that's it. I filled the tire back up, and it held. And I thought, all right, well, the reason I was willing to do this is because the tires on my truck are, they're just about end of life. They've probably got 10% of life left, and I think they're about 5 years old, so it's time for them to go anyway. So there's not much risk here for me. But all right, we'll see. Now, the tractor is a little different situation. Tractors are lower pressure tires, and they have a different wear case. You know, they're not going at high speeds. They're just going at weird angles and driving over weird things. And so I did the same thing with that. Now, this was the thorn that had black locusts, man. Black locust thorns are brutal, but that's what I had. Both my front tires had popped with black locusts. Black locust thorns because I had been moving trees around and just driving over trees and stuff. Anyway, fix the tires and pumped them back up, 22.5 pounds in this case, and they held. I was like, all right, well, this is never going to work. So I put them back on the tractor expecting to have to do this again. I was willing to do that. I had actually a whole spare wheel that was brand new that I could put on at any time. Well, it's now 2 weeks later. I have put 3,500 miles on my truck, and I have probably put 10 or 15 hours on the tractor, and all the repairs are holding. No leak at all, no loss in pressure, no sign that anything bad's going to happen, and I am shocked. I really didn't think these things would work that well. So I have to say that At this point, these are absolutely a viable emergency tire repair until you can get somewhere to repair it properly. And they're possibly a permanent tire repair. I mean, the danger here was that you would start leaking air again. They're not going to cause a blowout. It's just going to slowly leak air. And we all have those tire warning lights on our dashboards now. And maybe I just got lucky, and maybe all three of these I just did perfectly, and they were exactly the right situation. But at this point, for less than $10, I'm recommending that everybody have one of these kits in their vehicle, because it's dead simple. You don't have to take the tire off. You don't need the strength that you need with the T-handle type of strips, and you just really need a screwdriver. That's it, a Phillips head screwdriver. You could even use a drill. I did that on once. I tried a battery drill to see if that would work, and yeah, that worked just fine. You just have to go real slow, because these are short screws, and I thought I had ruined it. I actually sent a screw all the way through the tire, and I heard it fall inside. This was on the tractor, so I'm not too worried about it, but I'm like, oh, that's not good. I had used too small of a screw. When I put the bigger size one in, it held, and it's fine. So, crazy, but I've got a link in the show notes. I don't know what the official name is for these things. I mean, when you look around, it seems like nobody does. They're called tire plugs, tire sealing nails, tire repair screws, whatever they're called. The link I have in the show notes is an Amazon link, but it also includes another thing that I have not tried, which is this tire repairing liquid, and they're telling you can use it on sidewalls. I am not recommending that. Sidewalls are where bad things happen. If your tire has damaged sidewalls, it needs to be replaced. End of story. But it's not necessarily a bad thing to have this fluid, even just to put it over the screw after you put it in. So that's why I'm recommending that one. It's less than $10. Could save you from a very, very bad time. And it saved me from a whole lot of extra effort, too. Tales from the road. I had heard an expression a long time ago when I was researching. Actually, it was Flight 401. So Flight 401 was famous because there was a haunting and all this stuff. But forget the haunting. The story itself was interesting. Basically, an L-1011 is coming into land in Florida, probably Miami. I actually don't remember. It might have been Fort Lauderdale, because that would add to the story. Fort Lauderdale's the airport that flight of Avengers took off from and disappeared into the Bermuda Triangle. Okay, anyway. But Flight 401, there was a light on the dashboard that wasn't working. And the pilot and the co-pilot were trying to figure out what was going on. I think it was a landing gear indicator light. I could look this up, but it actually doesn't matter, so I'm not. And they're trying to fix this problem with the light, and I think one of them, there was a navigator on this plane, if I remember correctly, it was a long time ago, even like crawled down into the avionics bay and was trying to figure this out. And then the plane crashed! Because all of them were trying to solve this problem with this light, and they forgot to fly the plane! And I had some pilot at some point told me this, and it just said, fly the plane. That's what you're doing. When you're in a plane, specifically for planes, and something's going wrong, you're flying the plane. What do you need to do to fly the plane? Forget about the light. Forget about everything else. You're flying the plane. If you have a few spare cycles, sure, you can try to troubleshoot a few things, but you're flying the plane. And I actually had a situation in my Land Rover where that phrase repeated itself in my head just when I needed it. So I had the Land Rover Discovery Series 2, four-wheel drive, you know, fancy, chasing rhinos in the African plains kind of vehicle, although not really. This was the more wimpy version of a Land Rover, but still, it was fairly capable off-road vehicle, and I loved it, and I was itching to actually take it off-road. I hadn't actually done that yet, but I had snow. I was living in Vermont at the time, and I was able to drive it in the snow, and it was an awesome snow vehicle. But because of that, I got overconfident, which is something that happens so often with people with four-wheel drives. They think they're invincible, and they forget that four-wheel drive might help you go, but it doesn't help you stop at all. And I came over the crest of a hill, and I wasn't familiar with the territory. I was going too fast, and the hill was covered in snow. It was like an inch of that really packed snow that had a level of ice underneath it. And I realized that I cannot stop. If I have to stop, I can't stop. In fact, I can't even slow down or maintain speed. I am going to pick up speed until I'm at the bottom of the hill, and of course, at the bottom of the hill is a stop sign, which means I can't stop for that stop sign, and if there's oncoming traffic or, you know, cross traffic, I'm in serious trouble. And I had a passenger with me, and my first thought was to tell them, okay, we're in trouble. And I remember saying that, but then the next thought I had was fly the plane, or in this case, drive the truck. Rather than play with all the gadgets like hill descent control and anti-lock brakes and turning that on and all that stuff, I didn't. I drove the truck. I held the steering wheel. I took my foot off the gas. I lowered the gear. I put it into a lower gear, which caused me to skid a bit. And then it caught, and it actually started to slow me down. And then I just kept it straight and level. And just doing that, being able to get it to lower into a lower gear, was enough to keep me under control enough that by the time I got to the stop sign, I could actually stop. And I don't know, maybe things would have been okay. Maybe that vehicle was actually capable enough that I was underestimating it. But it didn't matter because I had that moment of panic like, oh no, we're out of control. And it didn't take over because I had those words, fly the plane, come to mind. And if you can instill that in yourselves in any kind of emergency situation where you're driving a car, a van, a truck, tractor, or plane, I think you'll be in a better mind state to actually get through the problem, because panic does absolutely no good ever, 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 ever. So remember, fly the plane. Resource recommendation. We were talking Facebook about, you know, what can we do to save gas, which is obviously not an easy problem, but it's one that's going to keep coming up. And somebody pointed out a website that I had forgotten about. And I thought I'd mention it again. And I'm sorry, I don't have my notes with me, but person on Facebook, that was very helpful, and I appreciate it. It's called flattestroute.com. And, well, that is a well-named thing, because that's literally what it is. You just tell it where you are and where you want to go, and it shows you the flattest route. Now, this is not a super fancy website. It's got a lot of ads on it and stuff. But what it does is it shows you, of if you have different possible routes, which way is the flattest. Now, I have to go to Gardner, Colorado for Rocky Mountain Star Stair next month, and that is not flat. I am going from 700 feet to 7,700 feet. And so let me look and see what it says is the shortest route. So it's telling me if I leave Chicago, although I might not be leaving from Chicago, I should follow I-80 and then through Grand Island. But when I get to Kearney, Nebraska, I should get off of I-80 and start heading south on, looks like, County Road 414 through the Nebraska Dunes Golf Course. And then I need to go onto US 113. And this is definitely going to be a scenic route, but it's flat. And this does not mean it will take less time. Oh, in fact, I cross I-70, but I don't actually take it. Then I get on US 40. Okay. And then that takes me over to Ordway and then down to White Rock. And then finally I get to Walsenburg and get on I-25 a little bit and then head over the roads I know to Gardner. So that is not a route I would normally take. But that route saves me from a lot of altitude gain that I would be dealing with if I kept on and, you know, went through Denver, etc. So if that is your priority, if finding the flattest route is your priority, this free website might actually be useful. Now, like I said, it's very primitive. You're going to have to root this yourself in your mapping software like Apple Maps or Google Maps or whatever you use, but it will at least show you the flattest route and give you that information if that's important to you. It's just another little arrow to have in your quiver of useful tools. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 295 of Built to Go. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And until next time, remember the words of Marcus Aurelius, who said, "You have power over your mind, not outside events." Realize this and you will find strength.